From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter Rodoud in today for Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. At a cabinet meeting today, President Trump announced his intention to declare North Korea a state sponsor of terror. It was taken off that list during nuclear negotiations in 2008. And the president has been active on Twitter, calling out LeVar Ball, the father of basketball players, including one briefly detained in China. The president said Ball, the elder, was insufficiently grateful to him for getting his son out of that Chinese jail. And he also slammed Arizona Senate Republican Jeff Flake for being insufficiently supportive of the GOP tax cut plan when the GOP needs almost every vote to pass it. But the president still hasn't tweeted about the sexual misconduct allegations against Alabama Senate candidate Roy Moore. And on Fox and Friends this morning, Trump advisor Kellyanne Conway dodged host Steve Doocy's questions about whether she wants people to vote for Moore. She instead criticized Moore's Democratic rival Doug Jones.
He's strong on raising your taxes. He's terrible for property owners.
So
and
vote
Doug
Roy
Jones
Moore?
Is a doctrinaire liberal, which is why he's not saying anything and why the media are right. trying to boost him.
So vote Roy Moore?
I'm telling you that we want the votes in the Senate to get this tax bill through.
But vote Roy Moore? Joining us, Ron Elving, NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent. And Ron, I want to start where we started with North Korea. What does it mean that the president has declared that state a state sponsor of terror?
Many Americans are going to be surprised to learn that North Korea has not
right.
been considered a state sponsor of terrorism. And as you momentarily ago said, it is an encore appearance for North Korea on this particular list. They were there until about a decade ago. The George W. Bush administration took them off for the simple reason that they were trying to negotiate some kind of a deal by which North Korea would back off of its nuclear program. That obviously didn't happen. And at this point, President Trump sees it as advantageous to further negotiations to pressure them by putting them back on.
Well, his language on North Korea has people worried. This weekend, General John Hyten, commander of the Strategic Command, said if the president asked him for a nuclear strike and it was illegal, he would tell the president that's illegal. And this comes after the first congressional hearing in 40 years on presidential authority to launch nuclear weapons. This was last week. What's the sense? Is Washington nervous?
There's a lot of tough talk coming from the White House on this issue, as on a number of other issues. And because this involves nuclear weapons, that obviously engenders a different level of concern. But when you talk about putting somebody on the terrorism list, in and of itself, that may not mean much at all. But tomorrow we're going to hear from the Department of the Treasury about what they might do for new sanctions. And it does seem as though we've sanctioned North Korea in every way possible. But all of this is ratcheting up more and more pressure on the Chinese. And if in some way or another they can finally pinch Beijing in just the right place to make them really, really come down on North Korea, perhaps all of this has a certain amount of method to it.
Okay, what about Roy Moore? First of all, why won't the administration say, and we just heard it, you know, vote for him? Because if you don't, you'll get someone who won't vote for the tax plan. If Roy Moore doesn't win on December 12th in this special election in Alabama, is the GOP tax reform dead? Why won't Kellyanne Conway say vote for him? What's going on?
You know, things have gotten to quite a pass when you have to be dodging questions from Fox and Friends morning show, because that's the president's favorite show. He says that is the one show that really tells it the way it is and that he really likes to listen to. So if they're getting tough about questions about Roy Moore, there are questions about Roy Moore. And at this particular juncture, all the White House is willing to say is we want our tax bill and we know he'd vote for it. We don't think Doug Jones, the Democrat in that state, would vote for it. So that's the end of all we're going to say. We're not even going to come out and say, vote against Doug Jones or vote for Roy Moore. Well, the reason for that, of course, is that you've heard the expression, people in glass houses shouldn't throw stones. Mm-hmm. That might apply to people who live in White Houses as well.
Yeah, because the president has the allegations against him. Look, on ABC yesterday, Maine Republican Susan Collins was asked if she would vote for the Senate tax plan as written, even though it, as it stands now, takes out the Affordable Care Act requirement that everyone have insurance. Let's listen.
I haven't reached that conclusion yet because I think there are going to be further changes. But the biggest mistake was putting in a provision from the Affordable Care Act into the Senate bill that's not in the House bill. And I hope that will be dropped.
Well, this weekend, some White House officials said that it might be. What do you think?
They probably will drop it. That seems to be a decision that's already been made. But if they do that, they're risking the vote of Rand Paul, who is supposedly the target of putting that mandate in. If he does not come aboard because they take the mandate out, then that might be a wash between the two. But look, in the end, the Republicans know they really have to have a tax bill. So what we're doing now is we're struggling over what's going to exactly be in it and how much damage it might do to some people's eventual argument to the middle class that they're really getting a benefit from this, when so clearly the primary benefits of it go to people who are corporations or people who are the wealthy.
I just have to get this in this morning. A second woman stepped forward to accuse Minnesota Senate Democrat Al Franken of groping her years ago when he was a senator. He says he doesn't remember taking the photo at a Minnesota State Fair. Is he out, Ron?
He is not necessarily going to resign, but his future is certainly much more clouded than it was just last week.
Ron Elving, NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent. Thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Sticking with politics, when you think about DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, you could rightly say that it's a legal issue or an immigration issue. But teachers groups across the country say DACA's future is also an education issue. 20,000 teachers in American classrooms are eligible for DACA protections, and an estimated 200,000 children have parents in the program. That's if it continues. Back in September, President Trump said he was ending DACA, and that's why teachers groups are urging Congress to take action before time runs out. State Impact Ohio's Ashton Mara reports.
They was laughing and making fun of him.
Was that before he was smart or after?
Before.
Okay, but what's then? Where's the irony?
Tiana Gilbert is a 25-year-old English language arts teacher at Roberts Academy, a public school on Cincinnati's west side. On a Wednesday afternoon, she walks her eighth-grade students through an exercise identifying irony in their latest reading. It's a typical day in her classroom, she says. But Gilbert says there have been more and more not-so-typical days recently, days when the questions her students ask can be difficult to answer.
Am I going to get deported? Am I going to be sent back? What do I do if immigration comes to my house? What if they come to Roberts?
The questions are common, Gilbert says, in a school where two-thirds of the students are Hispanic, a large number of whom are either the children of immigrants or immigrants themselves. Gilbert started teaching at Roberts 2 years ago through Teach for America, a national program that places recent college graduates in schools with large populations of low-income minority students. This summer, as a mentor for new TFA members, Gilbert attended an organization-wide training that helped prepare her for those difficult questions.
For me, in that training, I just had faces coming up in my head of my students. Like, I could, everything our trainer was talking about, I had a story for a student that, you know, followed that line or was part of that statistic.
Led by educators who are themselves DACA recipients, TFA's training course provides access to relevant state and federal immigration laws, resources for students, and tips on how to make classrooms feel welcoming and safe. 190 DACA-registered teachers work for or are alumni of Teach for America, reaching 10,000 students in 11 states. Viridiana Carrizales, managing director for DACA at TFA, says that's why the organization is pushing for legislative protections for the group. It doesn't just impact the educators themselves, but also thousands of students in U.S. classrooms.
Our teachers are, you know, experiencing firsthand the trauma that the students have, the challenges that the students are encountering every day in K through 12. So the voices of educators right now are crucial.
TFA has joined with other national teachers groups in lobbying congressional leaders to pass the DREAM Act. Introduced in several forms since 2001, the bipartisan bill would essentially make DACA law, granting a reprieve from deportation for registered immigrants who were brought to the country illegally at a young age.
These DREAMers are our students, and I believe that as educators, we need to do everything possible to see that they have the same access to opportunities that all students do.
That's Becky Higgins, president of the Ohio Education Association. She says the immigration debate affects hundreds, perhaps thousands, of Ohio students. Ohio Senators Sherrod Brown and Rob Portman have said they'd support the bill, even though they sit on opposite sides of the aisle. Here's Republican Senator Portman.
I think we ought to resolve this situation and do it legislatively. And I don't mind the fact that it's being thrown to Congress, because I do think that it was not constitutional to do it just through an executive action.
Portman says President Obama's 2012 executive action forming DACA was unconstitutional. He says creating such a program, one that protects undocumented people of a certain age who entered the country by a certain date, needs congressional approval. In September, President Trump announced he would end DACA in 6 months and tasked Congress with resolving the issue legislatively. The Migration Policy Institute says nearly 2 million people in the U.S. are currently eligible for DACA status. One in five are children under the age of 15. Back at the Roberts Academy, English teacher Tiana Gilbert says she teaches her students how to advocate, how to use their voices to share a simple message.
They belong here. They deserve to be here. They should be here.
And teachers groups across the country are working to make sure Washington hears that message, too. For Here and Now, I'm Ashton Mara.
You heard us report back in July about that iceberg that broke off a floating ice shelf in Antarctica, one of the largest ever. It's the size of Delaware, weighs more than a trillion tons. And you might also know that as summer nears in Antarctica and light returns, scientists were just recently able to fly over and see iceberg A68. Nathan Kurtz is the project scientist with NASA's Operation Ice Bridge. He was on the plane. He joins us now by Skype from Ushuaia, Argentina, where the iceberg project is based and where Nathan and his NASA plane are now part of the search for that missing Argentine submarine. We'll get to that. But Nathan, the trip you just returned from, what was it like to see iceberg A68?
It was incredible to see the iceberg. I've never seen such a large iceberg in my life. We typically fly over many small icebergs, and this looked like an extension of the ice shelf. I would say, most importantly, what we're concerned about is the long-term stability of the Larsen C ice shelf, because the nearby Larsen A and Larsen B ice shelves have both broken up in the last two decades. And so there's this southward progression of catastrophic collapse of ice shelves. And so the fact that this big iceberg broke away from the Larsen C calls into question how stable is the Larsen C ice shelf, which is much larger than the Larsen A and Larsen B shelves.
Right. And of course, if that collapses, it raises sea levels.
Eventually, yes. So the calving of the iceberg itself doesn't raise sea level. And even if the ice shelf itself were to collapse, it wouldn't raise sea level immediately. But the glaciers that feed the ice shelf itself will flow out to sea much quicker, and that will raise the sea level.
Mm. And I'm reading that you were shocked not just by the size, but that because it looks like it's still part of the ice shelf, but it's not.
Yes, that's right. When we flew over the iceberg itself, we first transited over the Larsen C ice shelf, which is massive. It's very big, and we're up at about 1,500 feet in the plane. And so I was looking out over the ice shelf itself, and then we flew over a large stretch of water, and then we came to the edge of the iceberg. And as we flew over it, it just kept going. It was just so massive. And we had flown over the iceberg, well, the ice shelf itself last year. It was in the process of calving. We saw a rift forming, but it had not yet fully calved by that point.
Well, when you say large, I'm still trying to reach for comparisons. Its volume is twice that of Lake Erie. That's a lot of mass. And as you said, these ice shelves do crack and calve. As you said, they split. That's not uncommon. That's not even attributable to global warming. But in this case, from having seen it, do you think there's something else going on here, something more than the normal calving of an ice shelf?
It's hard to say whether the calving this time was attributable to warming. That's why we're taking the very detailed measurements that we take from Operation Icebridge. We take laser, radar, gravity measurements, all kinds of things to study what all processes could be contributing to that calving, whether it's warming from the surface. So the Antarctic Peninsula has been warming substantially in the last few decades, whether that warming is contributing or whether it's ocean warming and ocean water that's melting it from below, which is causing this.
Yeah. So back to just how awesome this experience was. I mean, just very jealous. What else do you see there? Is it just nothing but white as far as the eye can see?
When we approach the Larsen C ice shelf itself, there's actually a lot of mountains, a lot of glaciers. It's very beautiful, very remote, so isolated, and it's just an amazing experience. I've never seen anything like it in my life. I don't even really know how to fully describe it. So on the approach, it's again, very scenic. Then the ice shelf itself it's just very flat and extends out pretty much as far as you can see. But again, we're still up high. We're at 1,500 feet, and it's hard to get a point of reference when there's not much features on the ground. So it's hard to really comprehend how big this place actually is.
Yeah. Well, you paint quite a picture, and we'll have the photographs at hereandnow.org. But in the meantime, you've been doing this Antarctica research based out of Argentina, which is probably one of the reasons why your plane has been enlisted in the search for this Argentine submarine with 44 crew members missing. What are you looking for?
We received a call on Friday to help with the search, given that we were close by the area and our plane is able to make long flights at low altitude. So we were looking for signs of the submarine, whether we could see it ourselves or use any of our instruments on board. The instruments that we have on board aren't meant to detect submarines directly. We do have instruments that could, if we were very close to the submarine. So we were hoping that if we flew over it with one of the instruments that we might get lucky and see something that would indicate that it was there. But otherwise, we were just doing visual search to see whatever we could do to help.
Yeah. Two important missions. Nathan Kurtz, project scientist with NASA's Operation IceBridge, speaking to us from Argentina. Nathan, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Okay, quick pivot here. There's a good chance that sweet potatoes will make a showing on your holiday table this Thanksgiving. But this member of the Morning Glory plant family, did you know that, is not just for holiday meals anymore. Americans are eating more sweet potatoes than in decades. Farmers churning out numbers we haven't seen in 70 years. Christopher Husted from Harvest Public Media traces the roller coaster history of this once again popular vegetable.
To understand the rebirth of the nation's love for sweet potatoes, we should first go back to the time when potatoes were in high demand.
In a world where millions are starving, America has become the breadbasket as well as the arsenal of democracy. Our farmlands and ranges must produce more food than ever before to supply our own needs and to help our fighting allies.
A lot of things were hard to get during World War II, and potatoes were easier to raise than some of the other vegetables.
That's my grandmother, Joyce Heisey. She grew up outside of Philadelphia. Her grandfather farmed potatoes and their orange distant cousin, sweet potatoes.
And then some things were rationed, so you had to do with what the best you could.
Planting 20% more potatoes this year than last, farmers in one American state seek to beat their 1942 crop record, 42 million bushels.
Regular potatoes and sweet potatoes were a staple in American victory gardens and on dining tables. Why? They were cheap and really easy to grow. And back then, we didn't have sweets like we do now. So, sweet potatoes satisfied that sweet tooth at a discount for Americans strapped for sugar and cash. Grandma Joyce says there were dozens of ways she and her friends cooked with sweet potatoes.
Sometimes baked sweet potatoes.
Mashed sweet potatoes.
Put some butter and salt and pepper in it.
Your grandfather, he'd like a casserole.
Almost like what they used to call a pot pie.
Bake that.
By the end of the war, farmers here were growing more than 3 billion pounds of sweet potatoes. But when soldiers returned home, people went back to work and the economy hummed.
It became cheaper to buy russet potatoes than, you know, to grow your own sweet potatoes.
April McGregor grew up on a sweet potato farm in Mississippi and wrote about the history of the root vegetable in her book called Sweet Potatoes.
We really had this sort of movement away from farming families, small farming families in the U.S., into working people, more industrialized jobs that mean people purchasing more of their food instead of growing it.
Industrialization of farming and the rise of processed foods left sweet potatoes in the dust. U.S. production dropped by a billion pounds right after the war, and it bottomed out in 1980. Fast forward to the 2000s.
I've saved my best tip for last. This is actually my personal favorite meal. I have it a lot. It's the sweet potato.
The TV host Dr. Oz was one of many sweet potato converts. For anyone cutting bad carbs or going paleo, the hearty sweet potato was a godsend.
All these diets that are, you know, have tons and tons of followers are really touting sweet potatoes as being this superfood.
As Americans were encouraged to cut sugar intake and eat more fiber and antioxidants, the sweet potato, chock full of vitamins, began to show up on plates again, as well as in grocery stores and fast food joints. Top chefs incorporated them as a quintessential Southern food. In 2000, Americans ate about 4 pounds of sweet potatoes per person. Today, it's nearly double that. McGregor says farmers noticed, especially tobacco farmers.
Right now, the largest producer of sweet potatoes is North Carolina. Those are tobacco farmers that have switched to sweet potatoes because it's a relatively good cash crop to replace tobacco.
There's one more piece to the puzzle. David Trinkline is an associate professor of plant sciences at the University of Missouri.
In the last 10 years, there has been a tremendous increase percentage-wise of sweet potato exports, a lot of them going to Europe.
Northern Europe, to be specific, where it's too cool to grow sweet potatoes. Today, U.S. farmers export more than 10% of the total supply. So, hungry Europeans? Check. Decline of tobacco? Check. Health-conscious Americans and chefs into local food? Check, check. Add up all of these factors, and U.S. farmers produced nearly 3.2 billion pounds of sweet potatoes in 2016, a number the nation hadn't hit since, well, you know when.
American farmers are working overtime to produce the food to win the war.
For Here and Now, I'm Christopher Husted.
And Chris's story comes to us from Harvest Public Media, a public radio reporting project that focuses on agriculture and food production issues.
And if you're saving for retirement, have you thought about what long-term care could cost you and your family? It's getting more expensive, and the government says that up to 70% of people over 65 will need it before they die. Jill Schlesinger is business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Her podcast is Better Off. Jill, welcome back.
Thanks for being here, for having me with you, rather. Sorry.
We're glad to have you. And look, this is not a sexy issue. I'm sure it's something we would all rather ignore. But if you're trying to set up long-term care for someone in your family, this is a big deal.
Yeah, I mean, look, all of us know that we have aging populations, right? And it affects us. So I just want to give you a sense of some of these numbers. According to Genworth, they do an annual survey called the cost of care. And we see the median cost of services increasing for all long-term care services by 4.5% this year from a year ago. Now, just to put that in perspective, it's about 3 times the rate of inflation. If you need nursing home care, the cost for a semi-private room, it's about $85,000 a year. It's huge.
Wow.
What caught my eye in this survey is something that's really important. Licensed home health aides, they provide a lot of care for our relatives. We saw a 6.2 increase last year, and that's $22 an hour. And you think about that, wow, $22 to take care of my mom or my dad doesn't sound bad. But, you know, if you think about 20 hours a week, that's almost $23,000 a year. These are big numbers.
It could totally wipe a family out. And I think this is where it gets confusing, because if you're destitute already, Medicaid can pick up the bill, or at least a lot of it, for something like a nursing home. But Medicare, it absolutely might not.
Yeah, I think that this is a huge misconception, because a lot of people don't realize until it's too late that you're right. Medicare and most health insurance plans, including Medicare Supplement Insurance or Medigap policies, they don't pay for these advanced services. Sometimes we call that custodial care. So you're right. What we find is that families are plowing through their savings. You talked about retirement savings. We're also talking about the generation below the parents who are basically saying, I can't put money into my own retirement because I got to help pay for my mom's care or take time off from work myself to care for my parents.
So if this is on somebody's horizon, their parent may need care in 2, 5, 10 years, somewhere down the road, what do you suggest people start doing?
Well, first of all, I mean, we have to talk about it. So I think our biggest problem right now is that we have a very difficult time chatting with our parents about these issues. I mean, first of all, it's hard to talk about money. It's also hard to then talk about aging and who's going to take care of what. So this requires very open dialogue, and you can't really be too pushy, because if they push back to you, you're going to get nowhere. But I want to be clear. The problem with this particular issue is that when you think about it, it tugs on our heartstrings as well as our savings. And so it makes it feel like, from the older generation point of view, I got to do something right now. And you can see people make lots of very costly and irrevocable mistakes when it comes to both long-term care planning as well as making changes in what's going on in their assets.
Very quickly, like what?
Like, for example, there's a lot of people who start gifting homes or seeing elder care attorneys who start putting homes into trusts, which may help you qualify for some sort of Medicaid down the road, but there's a 5-year period that has to go by. Mm. If you don't need care, it could be a very bad decision for an estate planning purpose. You've got to really do your homework. Please go with your parents to any appointment with an elder care attorney or a financial planner. You
All right.
need another set of ears.
Jill Schlesinger from CBS News. Thanks so much.
Take care.
The deadline for Zimbabwe's longtime and only president, Robert Mugabe, to resign or face impeachment has come and gone. The 93-year-old was defiant in a rambling 20-minute national TV speech last night, saying he won't step down and, in fact, will preside over his ruling party's Congress next month. The BBC's Shingai Enyoka joins us from Harare. Shingai, there were huge protests over the weekend, people demanding that the only president they've known step down. He's led the country since independence from Britain in 1980. What's happening today?
Well, today his own party have decided to put into motion the final steps to get rid of him. Over the weekend, they fired him from the party, and today they want to begin a process of impeachment. That process could start as early as tomorrow morning when Parliament resumes. And so the party really is making good on its threat that if President Mugabe hadn't resigned by midday today, that they would start that process.
Well, but impeachment is a trial. Is there any sense that he might go, or might we see a scene of him being dragged into a trial?
Well, it is a quasi-judicial process, but it's never happened here before. And so depending on which legal expert you speak to, the response is different. There's a sense that this, if the party decides to fast-track it, or Parliament decides to fast-track it, this could be done within a period of 3 days. Others say that they might ignore the provision that President Robert Mugabe has the right to defend himself, that he's also got the right to look at the accusations against him and compile his own response to that. As I said, this has never been done before, so Zimbabwe will have to wait and see just what this process will look like.
Well, and Mugabe has led the country since it gained independence from Britain in 1980, so this is all new. But who is running the country? Where is Vice President Mnangagwa, who was fired by Mugabe? Where's Mugabe's wife, Grace, who everyone thought was trying to take power?
Well, this has been a military takeover. They have said that this is not a coup. When President Mugabe appeared on state television yesterday, he appeared to absolve the military. He says that they were just carrying out an operation to get rid of criminals. And so because this is a military operation, if you like, there's a lot of secrecy. They haven't really spoken to the public about what has happened to Vice President Porco. Zimbabwe has two vice presidents. One of them flew out of the country, and he hasn't been back since. He was allied to the First Lady, Grace Mugabe, and there's an understanding here that he won't be allowed back into the country. Emmerson Mnangagwa was fired by the president a few weeks ago, and that's what caused this whole crisis. But the party over the weekend met and resolved that they would reinstate him, not just as the vice president, but also as the head of the party, effectively firing President Mugabe. So and Grace Mugabe, we understand, is also under house arrest with President Mugabe. So this is a situation that's in flux at the moment.
Yeah. And so what's the mood of people there?
It's back to business, would you believe, after the scenes that people witnessed all around the world over the weekend. Unprecedented number of people on the streets, the jubilation across all cultures and sections of society. And they had expected that President Mugabe would go. But after his announcement on state television yesterday that he still intends to go on, there was a huge disappointment and the mood has been quite somber. But there was a group of war veterans who organized those demonstrations over the weekend. And they say that if he doesn't step down, they plan to call people back onto the streets. But there's a sense that Zimbabweans, for the first time, have found their voice and that they will be willing to take up this call and camp in the streets until President Robert Mugabe resigns.
The War Veterans Association, they're the ones who fought for the split from Britain. And Shingai, just tell us, you know, this is very dramatic. It's shocking because Mugabe is a name we've known for decades. But what does it mean in the region?
What it means in the region is essentially the end, or at least the resignation, potentially, of one of the last strong men, not just in Southern Africa, but also in Africa as a whole. We've seen over the last 5 to 10 years a changing of the guard in Southern Africa. Many of the countries gained their independence through liberation wars, and there was a thinking here that they all protected each other. It was an old boys club and they were able to break the rules and they would support each other. But what we've seen with the events of the last few days is that the presidents around the region have begun to condemn and call on President Mugabe to resign, even though they don't want to seem to be supporting a coup. It really signifies the end of the strong men of Africa.
The BBC's Shingai Enyoka in Harare, Zimbabwe. Shingai, thank you so much.
All right, that's a pleasure.
And back in this country, lawyers in San Francisco start closing arguments today in a trial that's become a proxy for the contentious national debate on immigration. In 2015, 32-year-old Kate Steinle was out for a walk with her father on the San Francisco waterfront when she was shot and killed. The defendant is a Mexican man who was living in the U.S. illegally. He'd already been deported 5 times. The case was seized upon by politicians like Donald Trump, who made Steinle's death a part of his presidential campaign, saying it was proof the U.S. needed to get tough on illegal immigration. And this summer, the House passed a bill named after Steinle that would increase punishment for people who re-enter the United States after they've been deported. Alex Emsley is a criminal justice reporter at KQED. He's been following the trial. Alex, welcome.
Hi.
So the defense had acknowledged that the defendant, his name is Jose Ines Garcia Zarate, that he did in fact fire the gun that killed Steinle, but they say it was an accident. What's the defense argument here?
Yeah, it's all about intent. What Garcia Zarate told the police was that he found a object that he didn't know what it was, wrapped in some cloth or a T-shirt on the pier, and as he picked it up, it fired. He didn't know it was a gun until that happened. It's not in dispute in any way between the prosecution and the defense that the shot that killed Catherine Steinle originated from the defendant's hands. What's really at issue in this trial is whether or not he intentionally pulled the trigger on this firearm or whether it went off accidentally without him even knowing what he was holding.
And on the other side, what is the prosecution saying?
Again, it's all about intent. And they're arguing in order to prove a murder charge that the defendant intended to fire this shot. they have difficulty with the fact that it ricocheted about a dozen feet from where Garcia Zarate was sitting, then flew another 78 feet to hit Catherine Steinle in the back. The defense's experts have testified that would be a nearly impossible shot to try to do intentionally. Now, what the prosecution is going to continually point out, though, is what happened directly after. A single shot was fired, and then Garcia Zarate immediately threw the gun into the bay and sort of walked briskly away. The prosecution is arguing that he either aimed the gun without directly targeting anyone, but basically fired it on a crowded pier. They're also arguing that even though he intended to shoot directly at Steinle, at the last second, as sort of a novice gunman, he dropped the gun's muzzle and it bounced off the pier but still hit Steinle.
Hmm. Now, the entire reason we're talking about this case is because it became a proxy for the debate on immigration. The suspect, the defendant, just 2 months before the shooting had been released from a San Francisco jail, even though immigration authorities had asked the city to hold him until he could be deported again. And critics have said the whole time, look, San Francisco is a sanctuary city, and that's what happens in sanctuary cities and why they should be outlawed.
Yeah, I think the rebuttal from then-sheriff Ross Mercurimi and other people involved in the legal immigration realm is that these holds that immigration authorities place, they ask a county jail, say, to hold someone longer than when they would normally be released, are a violation of the Fourth Amendment. So if San Francisco were to say, never mind, we don't want to be a sanctuary city anymore and start complying with ICE detainers or ICE holds, they would potentially be in violation of federal case law in the district courts. So it gets complicated, but what is also interesting is in the criminal trial, it really isn't about immigration policy at all. It's just about whether or not he intended to fire this shot. Now, I think his immigration status will come back up if, for instance, say he's acquitted. Immigration authorities are going to be looking to detain and deport him almost immediately.
KQED's Alex Emsley, thank you so much.
Thank you.
An unmanned Chinese space station will soon crash into the Earth, but no one knows exactly when or where it will land. China's space agency lost contact with the Tiangong-1 last year, and now scientists predict it will re-enter the atmosphere as soon as January. Now, usually the end of a spacecraft's life is more predictable. More than 260 spacecraft have been guided to a spot in the South Pacific Ocean between Chile, New Zealand, and Antarctica, called the Oceanic Pole of Inaccessibility. It's also known as the Spacecraft Cemetery. Holger Krog is head of the Space Debris Office at the European Space Agency, and he joins me by Skype from Darmstadt, Germany. Holger, as far as you can tell, when is this Chinese space station going to re-enter the atmosphere?
Yeah, as soon as you lose contact and maneuverability, it is only a matter of time until the space station comes down. Now, the space station is at around 250 kilometers altitude, and we have been monitoring its decay so far. And from that, we can estimate that there's probably another 2 months before it re-enters.
So the Earth's gravity is pulling it back in towards the atmosphere. And how dramatic will the re-entry be when it finally happens?
So the mass of the spacecraft is 8.5 tons. A good rule of thumb from past re-entries is that 20% of the mass could survive the really harsh conditions during the atmospheric reentry and then touch ground. We should not imagine this like the impact of a meteoroid. A meteoroid will punch a crater into the ground. Mm. Here we rather have a fall of fragments that just fall with the terminal velocity of what everything falls with, so about 300 kilometers in an hour. And that's not enough to punch a crater. So we will find, if you're lucky, we will find stuff lying on the ground. More likely, it will be in water and never be seen.
Right. And if things had gone according to plan, if the Chinese had kept control of this space station, it most likely would have gone to this place called the Oceanic Pole of Inaccessibility. What is this spaceship graveyard?
So most safety standards ask not to do these kind of uncontrolled reentries where you cannot precisely predict where they will fall, but to do controlled reentries. That means as long as you have control over the spaceship and you have enough fuel, there's some sort of end-of-life maneuver performed that's big enough and controlled enough such that the trajectory of the spacecraft will end up over the South Pacific Ocean. And that's an ocean area that is the largest area of the world that is unpopulated. Mm. So it is about 3,000 times 2,000 kilometers long. So that will make sure that all fragments, even though fragments, even in a controlled reentry, can fall over a long distance, 1,000, sometimes 2,000 kilometers. But this ocean area is so large that even the fragment trail of such reentries will fit inside.
It's one of the most remote places on Earth. We understand it's 1,600 miles from the nearest landmass. How do you make sure that these spaceships land where you want them to land? How do you get them to this graveyard?
Yeah, it takes quite some effort to do that. You need to have an engine that is capable of performing really large maneuvers. So you can fire the engine, and that's really a big burn that you have to do, 20 minutes, sometimes 30 minutes of thrusting, to bring the orbit down in such a way that the trajectory ends up on the surface of the sea. And only by this you can ensure that the spacecraft will fragment over this unpopulated area.
Wow. So I understand the Russian space station Mir is down there at the bottom of the ocean, 2.5 miles beneath the surface. What else is at the bottom of the ocean?
Oh, we find five European cargo ships of 20-ton mass, so much, much more heavy than the Chinese space station. They have been dumped there in a controlled fashion as well. And beyond that, you find many, many, many other larger spacecraft.
Hmm. With more than, what, like 260 spacecraft now on the bottom of the ocean, is anybody concerned about the environmental risk of having all this debris down there?
I never really had anybody expressing concerns over this. I think the concern to have people injured is much larger. We have been analyzing, though, what kind of potential toxic material we would leave behind. So most of the things are aluminium, carbon-reinforced plastics, stainless steel. That will not do really harm to nature. There is, of course, fuel, hydrogen. That is toxic. But we know from experience and calculations and even observations that, first of all, tanks should be empty after the maneuver. But even if they are not, we found that in the upper atmosphere, they would explode and the hydrogen would burn up with the oxygen in the atmosphere to products that are not toxic.
That's Holger Krog. He's head of the Space Debris Office at the European Space Agency. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for your interest.
And by the way, we also learned the International Space Station will go to the spaceship graveyard when it falls back to Earth sometime like in the 2020s. So they better get that one right, too, because it is much, much bigger than the Chinese space.
It's so sad sounding.
It does. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC. I'm Peter Rodell.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.